you for being a Bump 2 subscriber. In the second half of this podcast, we talk about the medical system, its pros and cons, the impact of financial toxicity on one's quality of life, and Fukimo offers some advice for all caregivers. And then there's the emotional component of it too.
Absolutely. I know certainly the, you know, it's interesting. I deal with a lot of people who maybe have, and I always put this in quotes, they have good cancer, you know, they have early stage breast cancer. But, you know, the thing with breast cancer is that it's a long game. You can have a reoccurrence 10, you know, 5, 10, 15 years after your initial diagnosis. So there's always this fear or concern that, you know, that it's still there, that it's still kind of lurking. Or like I always say, like, we have to turn the car around, you know, and suddenly you're driving towards cancer again. And I mean, that's non-trivial too, to think about how are we optimizing patient outcomes in terms of cancer, but also in terms of fears, anxiety, scanxiety, you know, return to normalcy when there is no normal anymore. It's sort of like in post-COVID world, you know, we're all trying to pretend that we can get back to normal when our normal has fundamentally changed.
There's no going back. There's only moving ahead.
Yeah. I always say that's this, again, similar to grieving, you know, you don't move on, you move forward. But there's no moving on from being a widow. I would, you know, it's always, you know, my husband's always with me. His memory is the reason why I'm doing the work that I'm doing now. I'm not moving on.
I think there's a lot of parallels there actually for the cancer patient as well, in that the whole cancer experience is trauma. And until we address the trauma, a lot of people get really stuck in it.
It was a long time for me to think about how this has fundamentally changed my life. I always say spectacularly derailed. And then when you're trying to kind of find your way again, when you're trying to get back on a path, you know, realistically, you know, the path you were on is gone. You know, you need to forge a new path. That's hard to think that, you know, the person that I was in my late 20s, when my husband was diagnosed with cancer, and the person I am now in my mid 40s, you know, we're fundamentally, you know, we have different priorities. We certainly have different knowledge sets. but yeah, it's just, you know, what my goal was before, you know, having kids, having a career in arts nonprofit, it's just gone. And, you know, those opportunities are gone. And I have to be okay with the new me, which is, I think, you know, has got a lot of strengths, but, you know, some opportunities are just that, the forest closed over that path. And now I'm on a different one.
Now, I think for anybody who goes through something like this, it's a real pivot point, and you have a decision to make. Do you wallow in it, or do you move ahead? And I think that many people don't move ahead, sadly. And I think that in moving ahead, you're moving ahead with a totally different set of values based on your experiences.
Oh, I wallowed for a while. Don't get me wrong. I had about a year where I did not do much of anything at all. I wallowed. I wallowed. But you know, eventually you got to pick a path and start walking, because you will just go under if you wallow for too long. So I had to start planning and I had to start moving. So yeah, I agree. You have to move forward. You take everything that you've learned, but you have to try to transform it into something. You know, if you want to use an analogy of evolution or of a butterfly or, you know, whatever, you have to, you know, ultimately move forward into your new life. And it's hard because, you know, I, you know, being a cancer widow has really, you know, it's been the kind of the defining moment of my life is, has, you know, this occurred. And so now I'm doing this. But there's no going back, you know.
If you could rewrite your story, would you?
I would give everything right now, all of my successes, to be back with my husband, to be a housewife. Oh, absolutely. No question. I would be perfectly happy being nobody, nowhere, in a loving relationship with some kids. But that's not, you know, we don't get to rewrite our stories. This is not the challenge of living, is to move forward with the all of the heartbreak and lessons learned, and to become a better person. And because I was always relying on my husband to be the person who was, you know, the research powerhouse, he was a PhD, he was going to be the one to actually make changes for the better in the world. And so he's, sadly, he's not here. So it has to be me.
But you are making such a difference. I mean, you are one of the few people really tackling this financial toxicity, which is a huge topic. And you decided to tackle the whole medical profession, you know, 10 years out or so, 10 years out of school, or maybe a little bit longer. What's that been like?
It's interesting being kind of an insider out in this field, which is, you know, a lot of, you know, when we think about kind of, we all know medicine is expensive. So, you know, it costs money to diagnose and treat cancer. It shouldn't cost that much money, though. I'm probably one of the only physicians out there that thinks that physicians should be paid less. Radiation oncologists are paid too much. You know, healthcare systems are making too much money, even nonprofits, on cancer treatment. You know, we're selling people kind of like a bill of goods when we say, you know, X, Y, or Z cancer care is just quite simply better. Sometimes it's not, you know, I often try to convince women, you know, I'm at a brand name cancer institute, and don't get me wrong, I think our care is phenomenal. But sometimes the meaningful difference of pursuing care at MSK versus someplace closer to home that might be more convenient, would certainly be in network and would be maybe affordable for them, is very minimal. And so I try to outright just tell people, hey, you should get your care closer to home. I am happy to treat you here. I'm not trying to deny you care. But I quite frankly don't think it's worth it for you to come here. So I'm always trying to kind of, I'm always trying to convince people that don't need it, you know, that maybe they can get treatment closer to home. And then, you know, in medicine, I think, you know, we're constantly reinventing the wheel in terms of what's newer, what's best, you know, what advanced technologies can we use? And a lot of times I'll say, you know what, sometimes the best treatment, the most affordable treatment, is no treatment at all. So for example, you know, there are many women with early stage breast cancer, if their age and they have favorable risk cancer, they can maybe omit radiation altogether. So I'm continually trying to convince patients to actually not get radiation at all. With some, you know, moderate success. So, you know, it's interesting how trying to kind of fight the system from within. I just had a manuscript out about how few cancer centers are actually compliant to price transparency laws. So very, very few cancer centers are actually following CMS rules that they need to post their negotiated prices, which is a fancy way of saying, essentially, is, you know, like, we, if we improve price transparency, it will improve cost for patients. It's a kind of a long process, but it'll help, but not if cancer centers aren't going to actually comply with the rules. And it's, you know, it's funny to be, you know, again, in an ivory tower calling out, you know, the fact that many ivory towers are not actually following the rules. And it's just one way of kind of thinking, okay, like, how do we optimize care for patients, not for healthcare system, not for physicians, but actually for the person who needs it the most, which is the patient.
Now, for many cancers, there's a standard of care which you're going to get anywhere, whether it's at a local hospital or an academic center. The advantage of an academic center, I think, comes into play when you have something a little rare or strange and you can harness the brain power that exists in that ivory tower. But for most people facing standard of care, getting that care near your home seems to me to make total sense.
Yeah, you would think that, right? It's funny, I have a randomized trial, or I guess, sorry, not randomized, prospective trial that has, it's never gotten off the ground because I've never gotten any of the facilities that I have been a part of to agree to run it, which is to essentially assess outcomes based on where the primary cancer treatment was delivered and to actually see if we make a difference. I do think that there are some cancers where we won't 100% make a difference for. And I also feel like, again, sometimes care is better delivered closer to home where you can be sleep in your own bed and you can work your job and you can have your cat or dog with you. So far, I have not managed to actually get that trial done. Perhaps not surprising.
I'll lend you one of my impossible projects then to put on your list. My impossible project is a look at the reality of life post-treatment for people over long periods of time. And the things that I'm curious about, for example, do people who've had a certain type of treatment have joint problems? Do they get joint replacements? When does this happen? How does it correlate with some of the treatment or the time post-treatment? We don't have any of this information. And the quality of care going through cancer may be excellent, the quality of care post-treatment is almost non-existent for most people.
Because there are certain things that are well studied in survivorship. So, for example, there was just another trial that came out that looked at cardiac outcomes for women who received radiation for breast cancer. So it's a late toxicity, but one obviously that very much matters. Mm-hmm. I always say, I want you to live another 30 years. I would prefer them to be breast cancer free, but you also need your heart to do it. So I kind of need to do both. I need to protect your heart and also treat the cancer. And then there are some things, late toxicities that may or may not be related to cancer treatment that are completely undocumented. So we're just now trying to figure out, okay, like, is there an increased risk of anxiety, depression after cancer treatment? What about suicide risk? What about risk for long-term opioid dependency? What about chronic pain? What about, you know, functional status or frailty? I think what you brought up, the idea that maybe, you know, these cytotoxic chemicals that we're giving people are actually, you know, increasing the wear and tear on their joints, and maybe they'll need increased hip replacements earlier than would normally be. You know, these are all sort of unanswered questions. And it's sort of frustrating to think that, like, oh my gosh, like, we could probably answer these questions if someone just needs to be motivated enough to actually find the data source that will give them the right answer. And I can tell you that there's utilization, large data sets that could probably see, well, is there an increased risk of hip replacement for people who've had, cytotoxic chemotherapy for lymphoma? I can tell you that there's a data set out there that could probably answer that question.
How do you put it together?
Where there's a will, there's a way. It's interesting. Sometimes I have a question and I try to find the data sort that answers the question. And then sometimes I just have a data source and I just try to figure out what questions can I answer with this? And so a couple of years ago, for example, I discovered that there was this amazing data source that the CDC collects that's basically death certificate data for everyone in the United States who died. And this is all comers, not just of cancer, but everyone everywhere who died. There's a database with everyone in it, including my husband, including anyone who I've treated who's died of cancer. And we use that to evaluate, you know, where patients are dying from cancer, and found that there were, thankfully, there was a shift into home death away from the hospital. And that was, I think, really interesting to kind of look at, but it was just me kind of starting with the data set and saying, oh, what questions can I answer with this data set? we did a different study that actually just looked at autopsy rates and found that there was some pretty significant healthcare disparity in who was getting autopsies, not just for cancer, but also for heart disease, for kidney disease, for stroke, and found that, for example, Black patients were basically twice as likely to have an autopsy than white patients. Again, not from, you know, like homicide, accident, death, but, you know, from known causes like heart disease or cancer. And so again, the great, for me, the most exciting thing about research is that, you can answer such interesting questions, and I hope ultimately translate those questions that you answered into the next step, which is interventions. So for example, if Black patients are getting autopsy at twice the rate as white patients, why is that? And what can we do to improve that? And, you know, are there unanswered questions at death if you died of cancer? Is there mistrust that can be improved? Is there, you know, just the fact that the quality of care may not have been as good? You know, are there healthcare disparities that we can work to ameliorate? So the next step after answering an interesting question is then trying to find a plausible and achievable solution. So not to segue back to financial toxicity, but I think, you know, the bulk of the research to date has been to expose the problem, and we need to shift forward into actually creating solutions.
As somebody who's been a caregiver in the cancer realm, what advice would you pass on to other people in those shoes?
I think that to take care of your loved one, you have to take care of yourself. And that's the one thing I routinely see caregivers, and myself included, not doing. Whenever I see patients, and again, telehealth has been a huge benefit for me in this, I'm much more likely to actually see someone with their family member. I always try to check in with the family member too, and make sure that they are, all of their questions are answered. And if it's, you know, a poor situation or worse outcome, I also try to say, you know, hey, you're doing a really good job too, because this person wouldn't be looking nearly as good as they are now without the help of you. It's a group effort. You know, cancer is a team. It's a team sport, whether or not you think it is or not. I think for caregivers, you know, just making sure that they're actually taking care of their own health. We know that there's increased rates of depression and, you know, worse health outcomes for cancer caregivers. You know, it's always, you know, you put the oxygen mask on yourself before you assist others. You know, you really do have to make sure that you're functioning well too. I'll tell you that I have chronic injury from when I was actually sleeping in one of those horrible chairs in the hospital that is not meant to be slept in, from my husband, that actually every now and then still causes a limp for me. And I'm a, you know, otherwise a pretty healthy person. So there's all sorts of hardships that your body and your mind and your bank goes through when you're a cancer caregiver. And you need to make sure that you're paying attention to them too, because again, you're of no help to anyone if you are also suffering.
And any thoughts about people who are single going through cancer? How do they pull it together?
It is so hard. You know, I've definitely seen people who have rallied their friends and family around them. I do try to check in with people to see who their support system is. That's sort of like in my initial assessment, I say, okay, literally who's in the house with you? How far away from are you from my facility? And if someone's not in the house with you, who do you rely on and how far away are they? Because all of, and then that all goes into my notes so that I know later. Because, you know, again, it's very isolating to go through cancer treatment, and especially during COVID. But, you know, you will probably need some help at some point. And it's helpful to know, again, who they are. And for people who truly are alone, which has happened, you know, before, certainly some of the time I've spent in the VA healthcare system, you know, occasionally you'll see some people who are just truly isolated. You really have to marshal more services around them. And, you know, so that maybe that's physical therapy, maybe that's social work, maybe that's, you know, volunteers, could be even, you know, people within the hospice system. It just depends on kind of where someone is in their disease state. But, you know, trying to make sure that we're getting everyone all of the help that will help them get the very best outcome. And some people need more help and some people need less help. And there's no deficit in saying, hey, like, I think that this could help you out. And I guess that's a correlate to the caregiver, which is, you know, for caregivers, they should also realize that there is help. There's more help. It's not perfect. It's not going to eliminate all of your responsibilities or your needs or your desires or whatever, but it can make things just a little easier.
If you could just totally revamp the medical system, what balance would be in science? What balance would be in humanity? And which would rule?
That's a good question. I think that we, in general, need to be doing better to take care of the whole person. And again, with the siloing of healthcare, you know, you have someone who is a kidney specialist or a heart specialist or someone who, you know, deals primarily with joints. You very rarely have someone who's taking care of the whole person. So I do think it needs to be more of, you know, like we still need to treat disease and we still need to cure cancer. But we also need to be making sure that we're taking care of people's hopes and fears, that we're acknowledging their, you know, their uncertain futures.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path, because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.